day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements over Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He is the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint Leverett.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to talk with you.
And the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Zarif, met today with the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Catherine Ashton. And apparently they're going to meet later with the P5 plus one group, the foreign minister. That'll mean he'll be meeting with John Kerry sometime later this week. But I guess the real expectation or rumors or hopes are swirling around the possibility that President Obama and President Rouhani might meet. What odds do you give on that?
Actually, at this point, I think the odds are reasonably good for some sort of, how should I say, you know, carefully staged casual encounter. I wouldn't expect it to be a very substantive exchange. You know, the speculation is about essentially a kind of very choreographed accidental meeting. But I think at this point, there's been so much speculation about the possibilities of that, so much of a drum roll, that if it doesn't happen, that could end up being interpreted as signaling things that I'm not sure either side really wants to send at this point. So if I had to bet money, I'd bet at least a certain amount that the odds are better than not, that there'll be some sort of brief encounter.
Well, Flint Leverett, there may well be, it might be an accident of architecture, because the General Assembly main hall is closed for renovations, and they're all meeting in this temporary building, and in the narrow hallways in the cramped offices of the UN North Lawn building. So that could facilitate a, you know.
It could well make the architecture of accident easier to pull off. That's right.
So let's talk about the where we got to the position we are since, as Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, said that Syria is going to dominate the agenda. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that we got to this point with Syria with the so-called Lavrov-Kerry deal. It started with Kerry's offhand remark at a press conference in London, where he was asked what could Syria do to avoid U.S. bombing. And he said, well, they could give up their chemical weapons and do it in a week, and that's not going to happen. My understanding is that the Iranians immediately seized on that, got behind the scenes, got Assad to agree to it, and then allowed the Russians to take credit for it, knowing that they're kind of kryptonite. So is that your understanding of how we got to this position we're in?
I think that there was a very important Iranian role in particularly in persuading President Assad in Damascus to go ahead with this deal. The chemical weapons issue is a very, very sensitive one for Iran. During the 8 years of the Iran-Iraq war, when Saddam Hussein invaded the fledgling Islamic Republic back in the 1980s, Iran was subjected to years of Iraqi chemical weapons attacks, literally years. Over 100,000 people were killed or seriously injured in those attacks. There are still tens of thousands of surviving victims of chemical weapons attacks in Iran today. And with that experience, you know, Iran has, I'm not trying to question its sincerity, but it has been a very, very important and in some ways effective part of its public diplomacy to present itself as a victim of chemical weapons attacks, attacks that, to I think, as an American, to U.S. Shame, the United States blocked any Security Council action to investigate for years. And so they've been able to present themselves as the victims, to present the United States as in some ways hypocritical or, let's say, ambivalent about the chemical weapons issue. And so if one of its close partners in the region, like Syria's Assad government, is accused of using chemical weapons, this is obviously a very, very sensitive issue for Iran. And I think they saw an opportunity here to, in a sense, remove the threat of U.S. military action in a way that's consistent with its own agenda, which is to promote the removal of chemical weapons, especially from the Middle East, and to do so in a way that actually, you know, increased the chances for more productive regional diplomacy. And I should say the Iranians remain very concerned, as the Russians do, that it's not just the Assad government that has chemical weapons in Syria. They believe, and I've talked to both Russian and Iranian officials about this, and I think that this is a genuine assessment on their part, that there is considerable evidence that there are opposition elements that have homemade sarin, have homemade chemical munitions, which they have used at various points already. And both Iran and Russia, but especially Iran, are interested in getting some international effort in place to tackle that problem as well. And I think from an Iranian perspective, if they could be seen as helpful players in encouraging the Syrian government's chemical disarmament, it puts them in a stronger position to push for international consideration, international action about chemical weapons that and capabilities that might be held by other parties in this conflict.
Again, I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements over Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, just in terms of the atmospherics building up to this chance meeting, perhaps tomorrow, perhaps on Tuesday at the United Nations, where both President Obama and President Rouhani are going to be there, and Rouhani's just released 80 prisoners on top of 11 that were released earlier. He's had an exchange of letters with Obama, which he said are very positive. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. It would seem to me that if a deal was made, I mean, obviously there's tremendous acrimony going back to the takeover of the U.S. embassy, and prior to that, you know, all the way back to the CIA coup against Mossadegh. But the long and the short of it is, it seems to me that if the U.S. and Iran are able to turn this hostility, you know, it's like, you know, like the two magnets, instead of repelling, will attract. If it could be a quantum change, don't you think, that could really have profound effects on the Middle East and on U.S. Future foreign policy? I'm not suggesting that's going to happen, but would you agree?
I think it would absolutely have a profound effect on regional dynamics, and I think it would have a profoundly beneficial effect on the U.S. position, which has been in, I think, rather serious decline for a number of years. You know, in our book, Going to Tehran, that's really why my wife and I wrote this, based on our experience in government service, we saw, even when we were in government in the 90s and the early 2000s, you know, how much the United States could benefit from a constructive relationship with Iran, how much the Iranians helped us dealing with Afghanistan, the Taliban, al-Qaeda in the immediate wake of 9/11. I think in many ways we squandered those benefits and squandered the opening that that Iranian cooperation with us represented. But I think since then, you know, the imperatives for the United States to realign with Iran, you know, there's basically no major issue in the region right now. There's no way we can advance, you know, towards some kind of positive solution on any of these issues, whether it's Afghanistan, Syria, nuclear proliferation, what have you. We can't do what we say we want to do without a better relationship with Iran. And I think for the Iranians, too, they have fundamental national security and foreign policy problems which they can't solve, or at least can't optimally solve, absent better relations with the United States. I mean, structurally, this is overdetermined. This should have happened a long time ago. There are a lot of reasons why it hasn't, but it really should happen. I think it would be profoundly in the interests of both countries, and I think it would have a lot of really powerful, beneficial effects on the Middle East.
Well, it seems to me that we have been in denial for so long about this sick relationship we have with Saudi Arabia. And that, to me, is at the heart of it. I mean, we were just talking earlier about Somalia. You know, the al-Shabaab people were financed and created by the Wahhabis. The first thing they did was to destroy the Sufis, you know. And this is, you know, the Iran, Russia, and the U.S. has something in common in Syria. Absolutely. They don't want those crazy people ending up creating a Somalia on the Mediterranean. But it seems to me no matter where you go, you see the hand of this al-Qaeda-like fundamentalism. It's alive and well. It's flourishing. And it has an address, and that's Saudi Arabia. And they're just pretending that they're our friends. And I think because of the oil, we're just blinding ourselves to the malignant nature of this regime.
I think we are in denial about the extent and the consequences of Saudi promotion of this intensely Salafi, jihadi variant of Sunni Islam. I mean, the Saudis have been promoting this kind of Islam for years, decades, really. And it has caused us significant security problems before. You know, the 9/11 attacks are a good example of that. But, you know, since the Arab Awakening started at the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, Saudi promotion of this kind of Islam and of groups espousing, and especially violent groups, I think has really intensified, because the Saudis are deathly afraid. Their biggest concern about the Arab Awakening is that you might actually have Islamist governments that would emerge in countries like Egypt, or possibly even in Syria, that would emerge basically through election, through popular choice. And from a Saudi perspective, if Muslims in the Middle East can elect Islamists, then why do you need a king in Saudi Arabia? The whole argument for monarchical rule in Saudi Arabia is this is how you guarantee proper Islamic belief, proper Islamic practice, at least as the Saudis profess to understand that. And if you can get that through elections, the whole argument for monarchical rule in Saudi Arabia breaks down. And so this is a nightmare scenario for the Saudis. And the way that they have coped with it is to promote this much more radicalized, much less tolerant, much more violent kind of extreme jihadi Islam, the sort that you see in al-Shabaab, the kind that you see in the worst elements of the Syrian opposition. And this is really, I think, doing very bad things for the region. I think it is harmful to U.S. interests in the region. And ultimately, you know, these groups are going to come back and bite us. You know, the fact
Well, they already have, Flint.
Sure, they already have, but it's going to get worse.
Right.
And you're right, we are basically, because of our presumed alliance with Saudi Arabia, we are really turning a blind eye to this.
Right.
And it means you can't get into a serious negotiating process on Syria. It just, you know, in situation after situation in the region, it's just making already bad things worse.
And, of course, now you have the irony that the Saudis and the Israelis are working together to revive the military government in Egypt and
that's right.
And forestall or, if not, erase the democratic opening there.
That's right, because from a Saudi perspective, you know, they would rather have secular authoritarians ruling, as in Egypt with the military. They would rather have secular authoritarians ruling than democratically elected moderate Islamists. Democratically elected moderate Islamists are the worst case for the Saudis, and they will promote these extreme Islamists as an alternative, or as we've seen in Egypt, they will work with the Israelis, with others, to help the Egyptian military stage a coup and suppress the Muslim Brotherhood.
And presumably they don't support the dictatorship in Syria because of religion, right?
I mean, I think the main reason they don't like the Assad government. I mean, they have turned it in their propaganda. They've turned it into a sectarian fight. That the Assads come from this offshoot of Shia Islam. But the real issue is geopolitical. That Syria is aligned with Iran. And Syria believes, Saudi Arabia believes that if they can take down the Assad government, it hurts Iran, it hurts Hezbollah, and they're concerned that if Saudi Arabia doesn't support these more extreme Islamist groups, you might have more moderate groups, like Muslim Brotherhood kinds of groups in the Syrian opposition, come to the fore. And the Saudis don't want that either. And so the Saudi way of pressing their campaign against the Assads in Syria is to support the absolute worst elements of the Syrian opposition, the groups that, you know, even the other opposition groups can't deal with and are starting to get attacked by. And
so,
it's just making this conflict in Syria all the bloodier and harder to resolve through any kind of political process.
So just in the last couple of minutes, though, it would seem to me that the Iranians have done some things that have upset the Americans, and not the least of which was the hostage crisis, the bombing of the Marines, barracks, the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, and a number of other terrorist attacks. Now, this guy, Rouhani, comes out of the Quds and out of the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps. So it's kind of like a Nixon-China thing. If anybody can tell the radicals to back off inside Iran, then he's the guy to do it. And it would seem to me, at the end of the day, they're a much more rational and reasonable regime to deal with than the Saudis ever will be. So what's your analysis on that?
I think that's right. I think that the Iranians really do have a political system that's not wrapped up with a monarchy. It's not wrapped up with a particular family. It really is a system with various competing power centers and factions. And I think that it's also the case that with Rouhani, you know, he's oftentimes kind of superficially characterized as a reformist. And in an Iranian context, that's not really correct. I would describe him as, you know, a moderate conservative, maybe a pragmatic conservative. And you're right, he has very, very close ties to the Iranian national security establishment in a way that prominent reformist politicians usually don't have. And I think that does make him a potentially very, very valuable and effective interlocutor on the Iranian side. If the United States really wants to do a nuclear deal that is grounded in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, would recognize Iran's right to enrich uranium under safeguards and then focus the negotiations on, okay, what are the safeguards under which Iran will be operating? This is the team on the Iranian side with which to do that deal, with Rouhani and with his foreign minister, Javad Zarif. They are the A-team for doing that kind of deal. You know, I just hope that the Obama administration is really willing to face down hardliners here, face down the Israel lobby here, face down those in Obama's own party who basically take a neoconservative line on Iran, insists that, you know, they can't spin a centrifuge under any circumstances. Everything has to be dismantled. You know, that's just going to doom diplomacy to failure. And I hope Obama will have the political and strategic wherewithal to face that down and actually engage with Rouhani and Zarif in a serious way. If he does, we could see a nuclear deal, see the beginning of a serious realignment of U.S.-Iranian relations with, as I said earlier, enormously profound effects on the U.S. position in the region.
Well,
if Obama isn't willing to face down those domestic constraints, you know, this won't really amount to much in the end, and that would be a real missed opportunity for the United States.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Flint Leverett.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements over Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations about how to engineer a backroom meeting.